Welcome to Amici, news and insight from the New York Judiciary and the Unified Court System. I'm John Carr. Our guest today is the Honorable Salvatore Martocci, a retired justice of the Appellate Division 4th Department. Judge Martocci is here today to share with us a profoundly personal story, the story of the loss of his daughter to an opiate addiction. It is his hope and ours that Claire's story will help warn other parents of the dangers of opiates, and perhaps inspire those in the legal community to use their special skills and powers of persuasion to help combat this national epidemic. Judge, I know this is a difficult topic, and I appreciate you talking to me about it. But would you just please tell me about Claire and what happened to her and how she became addicted?
Well, first of all, John, let me thank you for this opportunity. I think it's something that Claire would have wanted me to do. Because as difficult as it is for me, and you correctly point out that it's not an easy subject to talk about, she was somebody who was always trying to help people and was at her best when she could do that. She was born on June 20th, 1973, in Geneva, New York, and she died on either January 19th or January 20th, 2017 in Lockport, New York. We're not exactly sure of the date because she was not found until the early morning hours of the 21st of January in her apartment. She was exactly 43 and a half years of age. I'm doing this for Claire. In our own lives, we must really strive to get beyond the stigma and inertia that we're all affected by when we talk about this subject. And her life is a book for all of us to read and learn from when it comes to the dual demons of mental health and addiction. Each of us has our own journey in life, and Claire's was a difficult one.
How did she get addicted? How did that all happen?
Well, I'm just getting there. She was a terrific athlete, very, very gifted young woman. She was very bright, and she was a gymnast and a swimmer, runner. Early in her life, she hurt her knees running, and at the same time, she had TMJ. And different visits to hospitals and doctors, in an effort to help her, they would prescribe narcotic drugs to assist her. Claire's chemistry, as you know, all of our chemistry is different. We're all different. Claire's was such that it really became addictive, although we didn't know this. And when you couple this with the mental illness that we were really too naive we didn't see it as that. We saw her as a rebellious child, sort of a hippie, sort of a free spirit. I'm telling you, John, if you could have seen her when she was in elementary school, the clothes she picked out, and she insisted on picking out her own clothes every day, people would say, how could this family let her out of the house looking like that? checks and stripes and, you know, different colored shoes. She was always somebody who marched to a slightly different drummer. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that she was the brightest of my three children, very gifted in science and math. And I think about what could have been for her. And the tragedy is even greater than you would initially think, because I think she could have done great things to be helpful to humanity. I know that she shared my belief that one of our responsibilities was to one another, and that she knew that she had to use her gifts to help others didn't provide her with that opportunity. So I want to say right off the bat, start out by understanding, John, that this is an illness, a sickness. It's a disease. It's not a moral failing. It's not a weakness of will. It's a disease, John. And if we understand that, and if judges particularly and lawyers understand that in their hearts, even when their heads understand it, sometimes their hearts don't. They really think it is a weakness. Mm-hmm. If they change that opinion, I believe they can be much more helpful as they do their jobs, John.
Now, you mentioned that you were a little naive. Now, that surprises me a little bit because you had a lengthy career as a judge. You regularly dealt with drug issues. You'd been United States Attorney for the Western District for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. You probably had hundreds, if not thousands, of drug cases. You had a big job with the Department of Labor. You're a public defender, a private practitioner. My point is, you were hardly sheltered. So how does something like this catch someone like you and your wife off guard?
Well, I think a couple of things. We were really unsophisticated at seeing the signs, and we were comforted by the information and diagnosis of doctors who said, you know, she would be all right, and gave her prescriptions to help her, that frankly, as I look back, I wonder if they were more harm than help. Although they were well-meaning, I wonder if that wasn't part of something that allowed Claire to camouflage some of the things that were happening in her mind at that time. You're right. I should have known. And
no, I'm not saying you should have known. I don't want to put it that way.
I know, John. I know that you're not. But I'm saying that I feel that way. But, you know, I worked on the side of the equation which dealt with enforcement and conviction and punishment. And we got ahead of the curve. We started to do a much better job than the people on the front end of the curve were doing, the people who really needed to improve public awareness of this problem and education, not education simply through the schools for the students, but education for all of us, for the parents, for the teachers, for the counselors. How ignorant we have been on this subject is amazing. Doctors taking prescriptions, hospitals using these things, often given false and faulty information from Big Pharma about the value of this, about the risk-reward factors of drugs, and yet they were fooled. And then, of course, it became easier because Big Pharma offered incentives, offered trips, offered a lot of things to doctors who used their scripts. And at the same time, because hospitals and the medical community in general were finding that the competition required that they not have patients complaining about too much pain, about too much of a problem, so that there was an encouragement for doctors and medical professionals to use narcotics to assist these people, and not really evaluating, John, the long-term ill effects of the drugs. You know, I concentrated on drug dealers, and I thought I was doing the right thing. I knew that the low-level pusher was usually an addict, a drug addict himself or herself. And so I tried to go up the line. I tried to follow the money trail when I was a prosecutor. When I was at the Treasury Department, I was the Assistant Secretary of Enforcement there. I tried very hard to get to the sources of the problem as I saw it. But I neglected, as most people, as all people did in my era, a whole group of people. I didn't realize that there were another group of pushers, and they were legitimatized by our society, the drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the drug stores, the doctors, the hospitals, all of whom wittingly or unwittingly gave these drugs away. Some did it for profit, as you know. As a matter of fact, in Florida right now, the Attorney General here has recently decided to go after drug companies, drug stores, not just drug companies. She had gone after Purdue, a big drug manufacturer recently, and is having some success there. But now she is attempting to make some corrections with Walgreens and CVS, and the fact that there were some apparent abuses with the scripting and distribution of legal narcotic pills through those through their stores.
Let's step back though. Let's go back to the beginning. You mentioned that Clara was an athlete and had been injured and got opiates, and it sounds like we know now that there are some people that should never ever get opiates. I mean, others of us can, you know, we'll get an injury, we'll take it for a week, and that's the end of it. But there, it seems like there are some people that physiologically in their body, chemically in their body, cannot take opiates. Is that correct?
That as soon as
they take it, they're in trouble.
You know, John, just as all of us have, we're all different. Our chemical makeup is different, and we are all subject to not only physical disabilities and illnesses, but mental disabilities and illnesses. All of us is mentally ill to one extent or the other, and all of us has different tolerance for drugs and things like that. I know that narcotic drugs attack the limbic system, and they provide an illegitimate source of dopamine to the brain that just allows people to make awful judgments because it clouds what really is important, what ought to be important, things like health and safety and love and all those things, which are supposed to be the things that release dopamine into the system. Mm-hmm. They get covered up, John, by the need for this demon, which really tricks the system. The cortex of the brain is affected, and it can be reversed in some instances, John, but the harsh reality is that we have done an abysmal job on the front end of all of this. We have, and in the courts, John, and I say this sincerely, we have learned recently, and I think due to Judge Kaye as much as anybody, that there really is value to these specialty courts, mm-hmm. where they can provide assistance for people, and where they really do view this as an illness, as a disease, rather than as a crime. You know, one of the things, though, that judges have to get and lawyers have to get is that you can't take the position that I've given them their break. If they don't take it, if they foul up again, I'm going to lock them up and throw the key away. That just isn't going to work.
Sure, I know the attitude now or the thought now among the more enlightened ones is that relapse is a part of recovery. But you know, you're in Buffalo, and I believe Buffalo was the site of the nation's first opioid treatment court in just a year ago, in 2017.
That's right. And you know, they had the first Veterans Court, which provided unique opportunities. And they've been a leader. Tom Amadeo, the chief judge there, has really bought into all of this. In fact, my daughter, Amy, is a Buffalo City Court judge, and she runs the Human Trafficking Court in Buffalo City Court. And, you know, it's a misnomer to say they're in Buffalo City Court, because although that's where they're located, they really function for the entire district.
Sure. She's a hub court, I think, isn't she?
For yes. The district. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I've had that discussion with her, and she indicated that in the past, what would happen with the human trafficking victims is they'd first get trafficked, and then their trafficker would hook them on opiates. And now she's seeing the other way around. They're already hooked on opiates. This is how they get into the trafficking. But to turn back to Claire, so when they first prescribed opiates for her athletic injury, a knee injury, I think you said, they probably had no reason to know that what they were doing then was going to be a problem. But what happened then? They prescribe opiates. She takes them legitimately, legally, and then what happens? How does it fall down from there? How does it?
Well, let me back up and say that as I look back at Claire, it was not just the drugs; it was the mental health issues, and Claire suffered from anxieties, and she was a very hyper person. So that she was always trying to find ways to calm down, okay? And when she'd mess up as a kid, she'd throw temper tantrums. And we simply thought that it was a stage that mm-hmm. she was going through and that she would get over it. She didn't. And I think that she found herself attracted to other people who had similar problems and similar outlooks. She was a hippie and a risk taker, a person who was not afraid of anything, so that she would go into situations, and she was also so smart that she was able to camouflage this. We tried very hard, John, to keep, you know, very close tabs on her, and to we were not neglectful at all.
Sure.
And as I look back, she was just smarter than us, able to fool us, and she graduated. She went from these drugs to, frankly, for one reason, I think, cost. The cost of getting narcotics illegally, particularly heroin, on the streets of New York State is less expensive than getting pills, so that more and more people turn to them as an alternative. And now, with the natural opioids being replaced by the synthetic drugs like fentanyl, you know, fentanyl's 100 times more potent than opium. I mean, it's just an atomic explosion. So that people, one false step, one bad dose, and that's the end of their lives.
So Claire got involved in this early on, and then it progressed from there. And then what was a progression?
Claire went to the best schools and in Buffalo. She really did. And then she went to college and graduated from college. I think during her college years, she progressed at least to using marijuana. And I think, frankly, that coupled with the pills that she was taking, and I can't tell you all of the different kinds, but Oxy was certainly among them, that those were the chief drugs that she abused in college. But she did so still with some restraint. It was after college, and the progression got worse and worse. And I think that as I recall it, Claire was both isolated by her own desire to take drugs, and yet uncomfortable and angry that she was isolated, you know, and it became a vicious circle for her. And since she was so secretive, and since she would blow up so much, and since she was now an adult, and the HIPAA laws prevented us from talking to her doctors the way we were able to when she was a little bit younger. And frankly, the medicine has improved a great deal in this area. They know a lot more than they used to know, John.
But she was able to keep it secret.
She was able to keep it secret. She was so smart about it and so conniving. You know, she needed money for books, or she needed money to take this trip or that trip. John, you know, we were not people who were naive, but sometimes in our desire to love her and be loved by her, we may have done things that in retrospect were not the smartest things to do. But as I say...
Oh, I think every parent says that.
Yeah. But as I say, everywhere you look, John, there's regret from every parent that's been through anything like this, because you can't help but self-analyze after a tragedy that takes away somebody with so much promise for the world. Claire was a beautiful, sensitive, just a gift, and I feel that the loss is not just mine, but it's ours as a society, because I think that she was a special person. But what are you going to do? It happened, and now we have to go on, and we have to try and learn from Claire's mistakes and from our mistakes, and we have to do our best to help other young people, other people. I shouldn't make that mistake of saying young people, because it's not just young people, John. It's people from everywhere. You know, when I started out as a public defender, it was mostly in inner city people, and most of my clients who were involved with drugs were either African Americans, the overwhelming numbers of them, usually people without much hope and much opportunity, and musicians, and actors, and creative people. Huh. I guess people who were suffering from anxieties themselves. And then I saw it grow to an urban problem. And even in private practice, I represented more and more people, but that was an urban problem, not a suburban problem, not a rural problem. And now, John, it has grown beyond anything we ever could have expected. It's everywhere. It's in every community. There's a documentary that I viewed on Sullivan County. Sullivan County could have been Chautauqua County. It could have been, you know, anywhere in the state of New York, and Jefferson County, places that you don't think of as drugs being able to get a foothold, and they have more than a foothold now, John. Suburbs, economically high-end suburbs, where you say, oh, gee, these kids have everything. Well, we've learned that having a lot of material things and even having a lot of love are not necessarily enough to protect us. That's why I'm so angered by the lack of response from the state and the federal governments. They are really good at triage. They give a little money here and a little money there, John, and they help us they support bundles of beginnings, but we never get beyond the beginning stage. We never get to where we need to get, which is to have real research research and development of a new and non-narcotic alternative drugs for people, although they're finally working on that.
What should we do, though? What can the government do? It seems obvious, as we've learned rather painfully with a quarter-century misguided experiment with the Rockefeller drug laws, that this is not a problem we can arrest our way out of. That's not going to do the trick. So what should the government be doing that it's not doing?
First of all, it has to fund, and it's not just the government. Philanthropies and foundations need to be part of the solution, too. They're sitting on their hands. We need to have more research, more in-depth research about what causes this problem and what protocols will work, because not all the same protocols are going to work for different people. Mm-hmm. We need more beds, many more beds. We need to fund longer stays. The insurance providers have to step up to the plate and provide for more time for these people to be treated. As I said, the state and federal governments have to provide more funding to keep these people in hospitals for a longer stay. And you know, John, we have to incentivize the very best doctors and scientists to get involved in this. And the way we do that is to pay them well and to have them, because this is not friendly work. This is difficult, heart-rendering work for all of them. But we have to make them want to do this work and incentivize them in any way we can. If we do that, we might have a fighting chance, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now,
I have a friend.
Now, I'm sorry. Now, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just want to say this one thing. I have a friend who pointed out to me something that exists in Toronto, Canada. It's a hospital for mental illness and addiction, John. And up in lights for the world to see, it proclaims that this is an illness, a disease. And you'd be surprised at the difference it makes in the public reaction to this. And also, John, they fund this thing so terribly well that they're really doing important research. Mm-hmm. We have this new medical corridor, John, in Buffalo, New York, that probably the finest thing that resulted from the Buffalo Billions. And yet, there's no hospital that stands there to make that same proclamation.
That's interesting.
And it should.
Actually, that's exactly where I was going to go. Now, when Clara was first prescribed the opiates after her knee injury, her mental illness was undiagnosed, wasn't it?
Well, yes. We had taken her to psychiatrists and psychologists, and different ones, a number of them, and because we were looking for answers, and there was two things at play. Number one, Claire did not want to go, and Claire was a very willful child, and she was very smart, so she could be very deceptive. So that the reports that we got did not alarm us to the point that, I think the illness demanded, frankly.
So the doctor would not have been in a position of saying, okay, I've got a kid here with a busted knee who also has mental health issues. Do I prescribe opiates? That question probably never came to him, right?
That's right. But we sent her to psychologists and psychiatrists as well. And because we knew she had anger issues, mm-hmm. and we knew that she had some issues with her ability to cope with the day-to-day living. And so we knew this. We knew this, and we tried. But she was too clever mm-hmm. for her own good.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Now, didn't she come out of it for a while? Didn't she get clean for a while?
Oh, a number of times. But the last time, John, she was clean for over 2 years and making real progress. She had moved out of Buffalo and into Lockport because she did not want to be around the scene, the lifestyle that could be so tempting to her in getting her back into drug abuse. Now, she was doing well and had made tremendous strides. And then she had a gallbladder problem. And she went to her doctor, and the doctor said that she needed an operation. So it was the same group that had been treating her right along. And Claire made a point, because I know this for a fact, that she told the doctors that she was not allowed to take any opiate drugs because of her addiction problems, and they noted her charts to that effect. However, apparently, the doctors and other medical professionals who were going to perform the operation, who, as they say, were part of the same group, although they were not the same doctors, were either too busy or neglectful and didn't read the charts or didn't read them appropriately. And they've put IVs into this kid that contained those very drugs that she should not have been taking, John.
Oh, Lord.
So they're giving her these drugs. And then in the hospital, when she wakes up, they're giving her more of these. Now, maybe you could say to yourself, she should have told them at that point that she shouldn't be taking these drugs. But remember that she's a sick person, and now she's been given, you know, you might correlate this to a drink. She's an alcoholic who's been given a drink, and now it's awakened all of those demons in her again. And then, John, they gave her a damn boatload of this crap when she left the hospital. Now, this is currency to a person who has a drug problem, and they can trade this. They can use them, or they can trade it for far more heroin and fentanyl. Do you understand the risks that they put these people at when they overprescribe and these drugs? I mean, it is just criminal.
I certainly understand the risks, and I'm stunned that they didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a professional. You know.
I know, John. I know, John. It is stunning. Now, I know that they're busy, that they have a lot to do, but John, this is their profession. This is their job. This is life and death. They need to be better at what they do than they are now. And they need to be less concerned about people complaining about a little bit of pain, or more honest, at least, and do more monitoring if they're going to feel that they need to prescribe more opiates for people. Then, by God, you better check them regularly, and you better keep them on a short leash so they have to keep coming back for the product, that they can't simply, sell it or get over, you know, overdose on it on their own because there's no oversight.
Yeah, that's a clear issue in the medical community. But let's go back to the legal community. What would, with what you know now, would you have been any different as a judge?
I would have been a lot different.
How
First
so?
First of all, I would have looked at this, and I would have been much more able to understand it as an illness, and not as a weakness, not as a crime. I would have understood the nature of, the likelihood of relapse much more than I am. I wouldn't have pontificated so much about one chance, and I'm going to give you this chance, and if you don't take it, you have only yourself to blame. That's born out of ignorance, and we need to educate ourselves better, and we need to spend more time at this. All of the courts of New York State, particularly the city courts and the family courts, are facing this problem regularly. And I think the courts are learning now something that I never knew, John, and that is that there is professional assistance that finally the state and the system, the Office of Court Administration, are being made aware of that exist, and that they need to bring these people into their courtroom and use them, not just as window dressing, but actually use them and benefit from their knowledge base and from the tremendous assistance that they can be to people, for even with monitoring these people. You know, we were talking about City Court of Buffalo and some of the specialty courts that they have. Well, they have not only a drug court, but they have an opiate court, because they recognize that the difference in the opiate users is that they need constant monitoring. And they provide daily monitoring for these people through various programs. My God, we have come a long way. And I was one of those Neanderthals who thought that this was not the job of the courts. The courts, this was the job of social workers and social agencies. Well, John, I was dead wrong, because you have to catch people where they intersect with you. And the courts are a perfect place to intersect, because you have a bit of a hammer there. You have the ability to offer treatment or jail time.
I understand. So you've got a carrot and a stick, and that may be the addicted individual's first encounter with officialdom. You know, a government institution, maybe their first encounter with a government institution may be a court.
That's exactly right, John. That's exactly right. You know, we have to use courts more as an opportunity for really salving, or at least making some kind of a dent in this overwhelming problem. I mean, I don't know how to put it, John, except to say that this disease is, in my honest opinion, more of a threat than terrorism. And I know that terrorism is a huge threat, but we've faced up to that, and we're doing what we can to protect our borders and to protect us from the influx of terrorism and the terrible disasters. But I look at the two biggest problems, one specific to the United States and one worldwide. The one specific to the United States is this narcotic problem, and the one worldwide is global warming. I mean, if we don't do something about these things, they're going to spell disaster. And frankly, the drug problem for the United States is going to be much more immediate. So, you know, experts have told us that there's more than 2 million Americans who become dependent on pain pills and street drugs. I mean, 2 million Americans, 63,000 people, over 63,000 people overdosed in the United States, and two-thirds of them were due to opioids.
So many more New Yorkers, many, many more Americans are going to die from an opiate overdose than are going to die from a terrorist attack.
Yes, yes, John.
Or any war.
And you know, John, it's not just the deaths. It's the cost. Now, it's, you know, we have spent more money to keep people in penitentiaries than we could treat them, John, in hospitals for less. We could send them to college for less. I remember years ago, I tried to influence a group of legislators when I was counsel to the majority leader, assistant counsel to the majority leader in the New York State Senate. I tried to get some people interested in using this opportunity to understand the difference between bad people and good people who do something bad, and try and rehabilitate, because it was better for the country as a whole. And there was the old Eisenhower College. You may remember that. It was in the Finger Lakes.
Certainly. It was in Geneva,
yeah.
I think, wasn't it?
I think so. It's become the chiropractic college in New York State now. But I looked at that facility and I said, why can't this be a minimum security, honor security institution where people can go to get significant help? College and high school assistance, very special, very small at the beginning, people who you believe could be motivated, and frankly, it would have been far cheaper because it would have been an honor system and all of that. And you know, the people that rejected that, even though it was such a good idea and offered such hope to so many people, it was based on really faulty information and fear. Fear that if we made a mistake, that somebody was going to die. Somebody in the locality was going to be killed or raped or something terrible was going to happen. And, you know, you can't prevent against all alternatives, all opportunities for something like that to occur. But it was a far cry, and it was far better than what could happen by not doing anything. And we missed an opportunity there. And over again, that's the story of our society. We put Band-Aids on this problem. We don't look at it as something that needs to be treated holistically.
Now, see, it seems it's kind of ironic, but at this time when socially we're having this considerable discussion, way, way overdue, on opiates. At the same time, several states have legalized marijuana, and I think it's probably just a matter of time before New York follows their lead, if for no better reason than to generate tax revenue. And there continues to be a debate over whether marijuana is a gateway drug, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, you know, I guess, first of all, let me say, it depends on your definition of gateway. If it means that you're automatically going to turn to another drug, I'm not sure. But if it's certainly a gateway to a lifestyle, John. It's certainly a gateway to a group of people who are risk takers and who are thrill seekers in a much larger sense than the general public. I'll say this. We should have learned from the experience with prohibition, that once you legalize something, John, there is no turning back. I'm not going to say that marijuana in the long run is not a better alternative, although it's still always going to be the lesser of two evils because it is not healthy for you, and that is a proven medical fact. But, John, when you look at marijuana and you look at the additional accidents that are now being reported on the roads of Colorado, when you know that you can't turn back if you made a mistake, when you know that not enough research, again, has been done into the potential risk versus reward here, you can't help but conclude that we need to proceed with caution. And the only reason we're not is because of the money, because this is an income stream that one of the few that's left for government to tap into. And they'll say things like, well, it's already being distributed out there, and it's, even though it's not a good thing, it's illegal and people are making profits on it, why shouldn't we make the profits? Well, you know, in Canada and in the United States, in those places there it's legal, they're finding out that, A, people who make it illegally can undercut them cost-wise. So you're never going to completely do away with the illegal markets. So my advice is that a thoughtful, enlightened society ought to go slow because there'll be no turning back. You know, with alcohol, we know it's a terrible problem. With cigarettes, we know it's a terrible problem, but we can't stop those things, because not only would the public not stand for it, but we're addicted as a state, as a country, to the money that flows from those things. Let's not become addicted as a state to this problem before we know what we're buying, if you know what I mean.
I do know exactly what I know what you mean. Judge, there's somebody listening to this podcast right now who is a parent and has a daughter like Claire. What would you, what would Claire want them to know?
Well, I think from my point of view, you have to love them, John. You have to never give up on them if you're a parent. You have to never stop loving them. You have to never quit on them. They're sick. They're sick, and you have to accept this as if they had cancer or heart disease. Even though you can't see it and maybe you can't see the effects of it, you have to accept this as an illness. Claire would have said, smarten up. Look at this and look at all that you're losing. Look at a whole nation of entrepreneurs and scientists and leaders that are being devastated. You know, it's ironic. We're closing our borders to immigrants. And I certainly am somebody who believes in controlling the flow of immigration. It needs to be legal. It needs to be regulated. I understand that for protection of our country and our people. But, Jen, for years, we have depended on the brain power of foreign-born people to assist us to maintain our level of living in the United States, our level of preeminence in science. That's going to be gone at a very time when even further disruption is taking place in the American citizens' ability to take those leadership positions, because a whole generation of people are being wiped out as a source of these important positions by this devastating epidemic that's going on in our country. I guess, Jen, I would like to leave you with a poem that my wife pointed out was on Facebook, and it came from Claire's biological mother. And I think I said earlier that Claire was adopted.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Claire was adopted. My wife took her home when she was 3 days old. I saw her when she was 4 days old. I was out of town when she was born. In any event, the poem is this: grief never ends, but it changes. It's a passage, not a place to stay. Grief is not a sign of weakness or a lack of faith. It is the price of love. And I have every day grief. And it will stay with me until I join Claire. And I'll be happy to see her. And maybe she'll be looking down right now and saying a word or two about how this maybe will influence one or two people to a better life.
Judge, as both a citizen and a parent, thank you for sharing what I know is a very, very difficult story. I'm thinking and hoping that maybe you're saving some lives today.
Thank you very much, Jen, and I am available. I want your judges to know, I want your public servants to know in the court system, that if there is ever anything in the way of information or a talk or anything I could do, I consider this my new vocation in life to try and be of assistance to prevent this tragedy from reoccurring over and over again as it is in our society today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Judge. Thanks for listening to Amici. You find all of our recent podcasts on the court system's website at www.nycourts.gov.
and most are also in the iTunes podcast library. If you have a suggestion for an Amici podcast, please let me know. I'm John Carr, and I can be reached at 518-453-8669 or jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.